Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! And welcome to the soft power edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. This week was the week of International Women's Day, so we're going to talk about international women with an international woman. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. I have with me in the studio Mr. Jordan Weissman of Slate.
Hello, Felix.
And international woman of mystery, Laurel Toby, who is, you're kind of mysterious, really, but Laurel, back in the day, for those of us who've been in New York for longer than we care to admit, Laurel was once upon a time famous for feather boas. Now she is more of a early stage investor, entrepreneur type person.
Feathering my bed.
Ooh, very clever. So welcome, Laurel.
Hi, thanks, Felix, for having me on the show.
Laurel is also a good friend of Panoply. We're trying to bring in the Toby Fine, family as much as we can into the Panoply network. If you want to listen to her husband on Inc. Uncensored, you can do that too. Plug. And then if you're really clever, you can work out which of the Inc. Uncensored people is Laurel's husband. But anyway, yeah, we are going to talk about this little girl who popped up at the bottom of Wall Street earlier this week, thanks to some $2.5 trillion global asset manager. We are going to talk about soft power and the way that the Americans are trying to crack down on places they don't like Iran and North Korea, by using various fines and sanctions and embargoes and whatnot, which is kind of interesting because they've been quite active about that this week. And I think a good place to start is SoftBank. Why not?
Yeah, SoftBank. Soft power, SoftBank. So
what is SoftBank, Jordan?
It's a giant Japanese conglomerate. It's kind of a throwback to the 80s. Well, it was actually founded in the 80s. But we like characters on the show. We like eccentric billionaires. And especially ones who are on the verge of becoming kind of a household name. And I think there's the head or the founder of SoftBank, billionaire named Masayoshi Son, is maybe on the verge of becoming kind of a little famous in the U.S.
He's trying. He's definitely trying.
He's working on it.
This is a man who has been a household name in Japan and China for a very long time.
And now he's tired of being big in Japan and he wants to be big here too. And
did you know, by the way, if you have a Sprint cell phone, like, he owns your cell phone company?
Yeah, absolutely. And he wants to own more than your cell phone, but we'll get to that. He wants to own, like, your thoughts, like literally wants to own your thoughts.
He's really into telepathy.
We're going to get to that.
So
you might remember him from this kind of press event he did with Donald Trump not too long ago. He showed up at Trump Tower and told our president that he was going to invest $50 billion in the United States because Trump had won and was going to deregulate, et cetera. And that was kind of BS. What was really going on was that, SoftBank had planned this investment fund with Saudi Arabia some months before, where they were basically going to pool $100 billion of venture capital money together. And
which is, by the way, whether or not this predated or postdated the Trump administration, the fact that this guy who's like a crazy tech billionaire from Japan managed to persuade Saudi Arabia to give him $50 billion to throw into venture capital in America is kind of impressive.
It's also an enormous amount of money. It's almost impossible for them to deploy that much money in venture capital.
Well, so it's not just venture. It's also like they're probably going to be trying to do some M&A takeovers. And this is sort of his specialty. I mean, he started this company, I can't even remember exactly what it began as in, I think, 1981, though. And it just kind of it just kind of branched into different parts of tech.
It was a software company. That's why it's called SoftBank.
Was it actually? Yeah. It was like selling software. It was ancillary. It wasn't like they were developing code or things like that. And now, you know, they own things like Sprint. They have an 80% share in Sprint. At one point, they tried to merge it with T-Mobile. They own ARM. They may be selling it soon. The giant chip maker.
They bought ARM for $32 billion. They have a huge portfolio, and in a very kind of Warren Buffett-y way, their portfolio comprises both publicly listed equities and actual companies. So a lot of his billions comes from, I bought a bunch of stock in Alibaba, and that's why I'm very rich. Or he also controls Yahoo Japan, which is this, you know, huge publicly listed company. But he also, you know, owns companies. He'll do anything. He's a good old fashioned, like, people call him a telecoms mogul. And I think if you have to call him anything, I think a telecoms mogul is probably a good description, because telecoms moguls in general tend to be very good at these kind of playing around in securities markets and M&A and that kind of stuff. Yeah,
absolutely. We were mentioning telepathy. So obviously he's this mogul.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right.
Oh, that was teed up perfectly.
Yeah, it really was.
You guys have practiced that.
So this guy, he's quirky. He has, you know, a 200-year business plan for his company.
I thought it was 300.
Oh, 300. Yeah, sorry. 300. He has a plan to try and expand his own life to 200 years, which...
Sort of like Peter Thiel, right?
He's really Tony Stark, I think. He wants this thing. He wants this company which just has fingers in every part.
And he wants and Laurel, you sent us this article from a former employee of his that said his grand plan is to control the world's data. He wants all of the data, which presumably will be generated partly by telepathy.
Thinking ahead.
So my question about this guy is he just like sort of a Japanese Peter Thiel type? Is he kind of a malign? What do we make of this person who is now about to just throw money around the U.S. investment market?
It's a little nuts. I mean, who is he modeling himself after? Elon Musk? Who does he think he is? He has said
good things about Warren Buffett. I think he...
Everybody he says looks, good things about
no,
Warren
but
Buffett.
He looks
Nobody
at what Warren Buffett did with industrial companies in the 20th century, and he's saying, I want to do the same thing with technology companies and telecommunications companies, what they call TMT. Back in the olden days, telecommunications, media, and technology in the 21st century. And he's trying to be one step ahead. He is also, unusually among tech people, very happy to leverage himself up and raise a lot of debt. He has $160 billion of debt, which is very, very rare in the tech world to have that much debt. It almost was his undoing during the dot-com bust in 2000. He lost basically all of his money in 2000, but he came out the other side, recovered. And so he has just an incredible ambition to sort of take over the world. And so I don't see that kind of cross-industry ambition in any of the sort of Peter Thiels and Elon Musks necessarily. They like to build companies. He's kind of vaguely interested in building companies, but he's just as happy just buying them.
The deal maker.
Well, so the money, Laurel, you brought up just the sheer size of his investment fund right now.
Yeah.
Is it good to have that much money sloshing around, and like, should one man have all that power?
No. And if you look at the other funds that have been raised in the US, at least VC funds, there are none that are that big. So for him to deploy that much capital into the US or anything close to it
to be seen whether he's actually going to spend that much money in the US. I mean, remember that all of his big home run investments have been outside the US. And I'm sure he's going
to
continue
to
invest in China.
In certain technologies that the US dominates in. Internet of Things, robotics, artificial intelligence. He believes that robots will outnumber humans in 30 years.
I mean, one of the interesting things about Sun is that he's incredibly good at, I guess, what Bill Gross would call shaking hands with the government.
Yes.
That he's done this very successfully in Japan. He's done this in Korea. He's done this in China. And it's very, very rare for someone to be able to do this in China and Japan. These two countries which don't normally play well together. And now he's doing it in America with Trump. People are saying that he has a very sort of short-term tactical aim here, which is that Sprint wants to buy T-Mobile. that it's very hard for either of those companies to compete with the two big guys unless they merge. But the competition authorities in the US have been kind of looking askance at this idea and basically signaling that they don't want to approve it. Donald Trump could probably make it go through.
Yeah.
And maybe this is what he's waving all of this money in the general direction of the US just to try and get Sprint to buy T-Mobile.
That's such a small, I mean, how can you give him such a small ambition? really, Felix, I'm offended for him.
So what's his big ambition? I mean,
besides telepathy and literally owning the world's data. I mean, he's actually an Avengers villain, like, as he's described himself.
So he's one step
from Ultron.
So Laurel, I mean, on a scale from like good to bad, like good to evil, is he like a force for good in the world, or is he a force for the consolidation of power and he's a villainous sort of Peter Thiel type?
Well, you know my opinion on all billionaires.
What's your opinion on all billionaires?
I love them.
All billionaires are good billionaires, except for maybe Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, except for him. Well, I used to be a business journalist, and back then when I made no money and I thought, I thought all business people were evil, you know, but now
and now you're rich. You think that all rich people are good.
I'm not rich by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. But definitely not a journalist anymore.
I would quibble with this idea that you're not rich, but we will get to the question of what constitutes rich in a future
podcast.
In a future segment, mm-hmm. Because I feel like we should move on to what should we talk about? Let's talk about soft power after SoftBank.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So soft power, this is my like nerdy news of the week. Yeah. It didn't get a huge amount of coverage, but there was
for
two...
good reason.
Thank you, Laurel.
It's a big deal. It is a big deal.
Is it a big deal?
It is.
I mean, they only blocked... Well, I'll okay. let you yeah. start.
So there are two little news snippets which you might have missed. One is that there's this Chinese company called ZTE, which is... you probably haven't heard it, but it's actually the fourth largest maker of smartphones sold in the United States. It goes Apple, Samsung, LG, and then ZTE. They make a lot of smartphones. They sell them all over the world. And they were using the technology, or they were taking the technology, which they were using in their smartphones, and they were quietly selling it to the Iranians. Turns out that's not allowed under American law. And the Americans found out about this, even though the Chinese were quite careful to like delete all of their emails after 24 hours and this kind of stuff. And the Americans found out about it and started saying, we're going to fine you. And the Chinese started saying, we're Chinese, come and get us. And there was this big sort of standoff until the Commerce Department came in and said, well, if you don't let us fine you, we're just going to ban Qualcomm from selling you any chips. And then they were like, okay, you can fine us. And then they settled with a $892 million fine, which was probably not coincidentally very similar to the $975 million fine that the Chinese fined Qualcomm 2 years ago. So it's all like tit for tat. But the point here is that the Americans have geopolitical reasons why they want to isolate Iran economically, and they are happy to use their sort of financial power in terms of being able to fine companies and regulate global commerce. Because ultimately, if a Chinese company wants to deal with an Iranian company, it's not obvious why the Americans should be able to control that, but they can and they do. The other thing which also happened is that Swift, which is a Belgian company, which basically helps to move money around the world between banks, found out that three North Korean banks were using SWIFT to transfer money in and out of North Korea, which, again, the Americans were like, you can't do that. That's North Korea. And we don't allow people to, you know, even if they're Belgian, to do things with North Korea. And so they slapped down SWIFT and fined them, and the UN got very upset and that kind of thing. So the point here is that the Americans are really meddling in international commerce for their own geopolitical ends.
So the other part of the SWIFT story is that SWIFT itself then kicked three North Korean banks off of the system. And Felix, for given your love of hyperbole, I'm actually kind of surprised how you kind of undersold SWIFT. I mean, they're kind of like the arteries of the global financial system. All the money, they are the one who control payments and transfers between banks. They are, if you are cut off from SWIFT, you cannot function in the financial system. And what's interesting about this is the first time SWIFT really cut off a country was Iran. This was a while back when the U.S. and EU sanctioned Iran. SWIFT cut off the entire country. And that was basically dropping the nuke financially on the Iranians. It left them having to barter, like they were bartering oil, things like that, for food. I mean, like, that is what it reduced their economy to. And now you're seeing sort of a repeat of that begin again with North Korea.
Well, I mean, so you're seeing it, and you've seen it with North Korea. The SWIFT basically told all of the North Korean banks that they weren't allowed to use the system. They effectively cut it off. And then, weirdly, and I don't entirely understand how this happened, three North Korean banks were like, oh, we're not allowed to use SWIFT? Hey, we're just going to use it anyway. And they get used it anyway. And eventually SWIFT was like, okay, we're kicking you off the system instead of just not allowing you to use the system. But yeah, North Korea and Iran are both, to all intents and purposes, banned from using SWIFT.
I mean, how much business are they doing through SWIFT anyway with other countries? I didn't
None.
Realize.
That was the whole point.
Now,
they've been banned.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that North Korea had that much international import-export business.
Well, it does with coal, things like that, in China.
Yeah.
And
oh,
Iran,
yeah,
Iran was. China. Iran was a heavy oil exporter, and now it's getting to do it again because they've been reconnected. But I do think it's interesting. We talk about U.S. soft power. This is like when soft power almost verges on hard power,
right?
This is when, okay, we're not literally launching a Scud missile at you, but we are going to reduce your economy to a non-functional pre-modern financial state. Or we have the power to do that as long as this company, SWIFT, is willing to go along with it. And they're starting to show the willingness to do that more often.
And the point is that America is pretty much the only country in the world which has this power. The Belgians, even though SWIFT is technically a Belgian company, like, those Belgians couldn't wake up one morning and say, we want to punish the Congo, or, you know, and then cut them off, and SWIFT would be like, oh, okay, Congo, you're cut off. Like, it's only the Americans who can do this, partly because every single international financial institution needs to have some kind of a presence in New York, because all financial transactions in one way or another become dollarized at some point along the chain. But the question is, like, if the United States becomes a little bit more sort of isolationist and unpopular globally, like, will it still be able to wield this awesome power that it has?
No.
Why not? Care to make the argument? Why not?
I just don't think that. I think if we step back and stop engaging in the world and world economic policies and world affairs as we seem to be doing, that we're not going to be able to exercise soft power in any way, shape, or form.
So I guess the follow-up question, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it good that America can basically police the world like this and use its power to punish entire countries? Or ultimately, if China wants to do business with Iran, should they be able to?
You know, my stance on this is, I'm skeptical that we're ever going to retreat so far from global affairs that we, you know, our sheer size
what
isn't going to give us that.
Look at our budget. I mean, look at the budget that we're setting right now for, we're going to disengage, so the military budget, for example.
Well, military budget's going up, they want.
It's going up, but the soft power stuff is going down.
Yeah, they like want to abolish half of the State Department.
Yeah, but that isn't going to change the fact that fundamentally we are the center of the global financial system. Like, that's not going to change anytime soon. Donald Trump would have to really fuck things up badly for that to change. I mean, who knows? Maybe he could maybe he could reduce the whole, you know, U.S. financial system to rubble and thing. People would start to rethink whether or not they want, like, the dollar to be the world's reserve currency. But so long as, like, the world runs on the dollar, I think we are going to have a lever in SWIFT and be able to use that.
And also, not just SWIFT, as we've seen with this fine on ZTE, you know, like, if a Chinese company wants to deal with the Iranians, we can punish them like via the Commerce Department. Well,
in that case, I think, though, isn't part of the legal issue there that CTE is listed as in America? It, like, they did the Alibaba thing where they listed on a
I don't think
exchange.
It has anything to do with CTE's shares. It just the main thing is that it has to do with the fact that we live in a globalized economy, and the Americans told, you know, basically threatened CTE with banning all U.S. companies from supplying anything to them. This is good old-fashioned, you know, mercantilist sort of, like, we're going to, like, hit your supply chain.
I guess there are geopolitical issues, like whether or not a country that sponsors terrorism gets nukes, that I think sort of merit stopping up the free flow of capitalism once in a while. I can't get too worked up about it, I guess, personally. That's just me.
But why would they stop, like, phone parts from being exported? I mean, that just makes no sense. I mean, that's just hitting the people, right? It's not hitting the military-industrial complex or anything like that.
It's hitting a company that did business with Iran, and the point is they wanted to isolate Iran. And so that's the, you know, it's indirect. I agree that it's sort of roundabout, but it sort of seems like an absurd result. But if your goal is to make a country radioactive, metaphorically, not literally.
It seems to have worked, too,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
But getting back to my point about the military budget, they really are reducing all of the programs that made people love us around the world. And when they continue to do that, I think that affects us. That hurts the U.S. That hurts our reputation. It hurts, you know, all those people who hated us after we went into Iraq. we had a chance with them. We could bring them back into the fold.
I feel a segue coming on here. This idea that, like, a large hegemonic global force is going to try and, you know, make people love it is going to be the subject of our next segment.
Seriously.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Laurel.
Yes. Felix.
The Americans love to be loved, or used to love to be loved before we elected Donald Trump, as does this large corporation called State Street Global Investors.
Tell me about it.
So who are they and what have they gone done?
So State Street Global Advisors is the third largest asset manager in the world. And they have decided to take on gender inequality on boards, which
is a kind of like pet issue.
Yeah. And they started doing it back in 2015, 2016. So last year, they announced that they were going to do a SPDR, an ETF that was based on gender diversity. So they were going to create an ETF all around companies that have gender diversity. And then 1 year to the day later, they've announced that they are going to hold the Russell 3000 companies feet to the fire. They're going to actually use their proxy voting power to make sure that these companies have more than one, two, three women on the board. And right now, they don't have any women on the boards.
A lot of them don't have any women on the boards. And my view of this is rather less rosy. I feel like their gender diversity ETF was, you know, the 2016 International Women's Day publicity stunt, which got absolutely no traction and has about $5 under management.
Which is maybe why they're putting a little statue down on Wall Street this year.
And now
that worked fabulously.
The 2017 International Women's Day stunt involved installing a statue opposite the famous bull statue down at the bottom of Wall Street of a little girl, which I have no idea quite what this all means, but it got a huge amount of press. I saw it being retweeted into my feed a million times.
It's a fearless little, it's a brass sculpture of a little girl staring down the Wall Street bull, staring down the aggressive macho visage of American capitalism with nary a care in the world.
It's
Felix, are you saying you don't believe that companies should have more females on boards and that whole MSCI, that's a market index provider, that did their research a couple of years back that said that companies with more female executive staff performed better? You don't believe that?
Oh, I totally believe that. And I believe that the Russell 3000 doesn't have enough women board members. I believe that the Russell 3000 doesn't have enough female executives. But can I just explain here?
I will push back on that.
Can I just say, like, you are so skeptical. You're a terrible skeptic. You should really just embrace State Street. What other big asset manager in the world is doing this?
Okay,
I want to kiss them.
And I want to ask you what they are doing, because if you actually look at what they are doing, this idea of they're cracking down on companies which don't have lots of female board members, this is totally not true. Let me tell you what they are actually doing.
Yeah, tell me what they're actually doing, because I read up on it too.
Is that they have announced that in a year's time, like they're doing actually nothing right now, but in a year's time, if these companies with no female board members, if you have one, it's fine. If you have zero female board members, then as of a year from now, if you still have zero board members and you can't persuade State Street that you have made moves to get more female representation on your board, then if and when the chairman of your nominating committee gets re-nominated for a board seat, they will vote against that individual. I mean, come on.
Okay. Fair. But I mean, at least they're doing something, right?
I feel like at least they're doing something is like the lowest possible
Should they divest completely?
No, divesting does no good at all.
So I guess there's a bigger issue about this whole thing. It just kind of bugs me, which is this notion that whenever there's a good social cause, like just gender equity, getting women on boards, it's just like a good thing, period. I think it's like a priori good thing. People always feel compelled to make a business case for it too. There has to be a business case why women are on boards. And that's how this has kind of evolved, right? It's like, well, companies with women on boards make more money. And this whole idea is kind of based on basically some research done by some consulting firms that really, it's kind of crude. The research, once actual academics have kind of looked into it, it doesn't hold up. You know, when you actually do more sophisticated regressions to try to, you know, control for all the, different variables, it doesn't seem to have
no
much
causal
effect.
Relationship.
There's no causal relation. Exactly. There's no obvious thing that having women on boards
it's just
does
a coincidence.
I think to some extent, it's hard to say, you know, organizationally what it would do, especially since boards oftentimes are so weak to begin with. Right. Oftentimes the boards themselves are basically sinecures that don't have much of an oversight role. So I think we should have women on boards because insofar as just having equity, you know, gender equity in our power structure and in America. But the idea that State Street's doing this for the benefit of shareholders or anything, it's just like, it just kind of perpetuates this like
and
weird
plus
idea.
Plus, the other thing is that they're acting actually where it's going to make the least amount of difference. If you go from having zero women on your board to having one woman on your board, and then like once you have one woman, State Street is like, okay, now you're off our shit list. You know, that actually doesn't make much difference. Where it makes a difference is when you have more than 30%.
Right.
Once female representation on the board goes above 30%, that's when the women start getting actual power and being able to influence the company.
I don't think they said that they're going to be happy if you have more.
No, they're not going. I'm not saying they're going to be happy.
I think they're pushing for 30%.
They would love more, but the only time they're actually going to do something, and remember that the worst they're threatening is to vote against the re-election of the chairman of the nominating committee. I mean, this is not exactly like nuclear power here, but like the worst that they're threatening, they're only going to do to boards, to women with to companies with no women on their boards.
If nobody takes any stand, and they did give some prescriptive measures that can be taken, which are going to be completely ignored
because no one cares what State Street says about prescriptive measures.
So one of the measures that I liked that they brought forward was that you have to assess the current level of gender diversity on the board and within management rights. You have to address behavioral gender bias in the director search and the nomination process. I think that's really, really interesting. They're actually saying, go beyond, oh, we can't find any girls for this job.
Of course. Yeah, you should totally do this. And almost every company will pay lip service to these kind of ideals. And I approve of that. And I think all companies should do that. And I think investors should make noises about that. And I don't think that a stupid publicity stunt on Wall Street makes any difference.
Well, I don't know. I think they're trying to be models. They have 3 women on their board now.
How many board members do they have?
Like 10 or 11. So, no, but they have 3 women. One was brought on board in 2015, recently. But the other 2 have been there since 2000 and 2006. So, you know, they've been, I think those women have been agitating for years for State Street to take a stand, and they're taking a stand.
And now that we have the weakest possible stand, which, by the way, this stand, which you're calling a stand, which is such a weak and pathetic stand, is also being done mostly in the interests of marketing. You know,
yeah, they have to get that spider off the ground. ETF really has to do well.
It was come with McCann.
The sculpture was actually
an advertising firm came up with it.
Exactly. It was invented by an ad company.
Who else was going to come up with it?
It's like sub-Banksy symbolism. I mean, really?
You know, something else I like about State Street.
I'm not going to give them credit for their marketing campaign.
Can I just say something?
I am going to give them an entire segment on Slate Money.
Look at this report they did like a year or two ago. You know, they're putting their money where their mouths are.
How much money?
I don't know how much it costs, but they did this whole addressing gender folklore study, which I thought was interesting.
They released a study. How is that putting your money where your mouth is?
Because, they paid a consultant to do it.
Because they're... because they're teeing things up so that they can make this huge change. And I think their next step is going to be to take money out of the companies that don't have women running them.
I'll believe that when I see it.
That would actually be fine. Okay, so if that happens.
I think their next step
in like 50 years' time.
No, in 50 years' time, 2055, 50% of board members will be women according to the current trajectory that we're on.
If past trends continue.
Yeah.
But before we leave the subject, because we do like to talk about art on this show, can we just talk about the sculpture for a second?
It's beautiful.
I think it should stay.
It's beautiful, but if I had to,
certainly better than that fucking bull.
If I had to approach it though from a gender, you know, perspective, I would say, why couldn't it be just an adult woman? Why are we always made into children? Why do we have to smile all the time?
mean, yeah, no. Artistically, it has very little.
Why couldn't it be a woman instead of a child?
I just don't understand. I like that. The surrealness of it. The little girl with the bull coming at her. I think it's good. And people are like, what is this about? It makes it more confusing.
Everyone more stupid.
Yeah, I don't understand that. But
yeah, I said sub Banksy symbolism before, and I'm sticking with sub Banksy symbolism.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, so let's have a numbers round because numbers are fun.
So my number is 250 petabytes. That's the 250 petabytes per gram of DNA that can now be stored in a sugar cube. Isn't that cool?
So what we're talking about here is this technology where people have been able to put like a French movie and an Amazon gift card into like they've coded it into DNA, which can be replicated. And of course, if you can replicate it perfectly, which you can store it all over the world very easily. And then you can...
How come you know more about my number than I do?
Take the information out with at great expense. There's no like... This isn't what you call a fast storage mechanism. It takes a lot of time and effort to put it on.
This is the future.
It sounds like something that Masayoshi-san would really be into.
I can guarantee you that somewhere in his portfolio, Masayoshi-san is looking into DNA as a data storage mechanism.
He's going to replicate himself, his brain across the world and store it in places like... anyway, sorry.
I bet you guys don't have a bigger number than mine.
I have a smaller number. My number is 650,000. Which is the number of pounds that George Osborne is being paid by BlackRock for one day a week of work. Actually, it's rather more than that because he's getting an equity grant and various other things. For those of you who don't remember, George Osborne was an entirely forgettable British finance minister, up until not too long ago. And he's still an MP, and he's now making 10 times his MP salary by doing this like four-day-a-month random like get wheeled out at conferences job for BlackRock.
That's like a fucking crazy version of the corruption that goes on in New York state government. Like, except like it's done on the level of a guy you used to. Anyway,
George Osborne. Jesus. I mean, like I know this because I'm English, but he was this kind of joke of a finance minister. Everyone would like laugh at him.
He looks the part though.
He looked like he's just the most gormless chancellor we've ever had. No one could really take him seriously.
Did you say gormless?
I did.
It's a good word.
Well done.
Anyway, well done, George, for your like 800K sinecure.
Way to get that money. Okay, so my number is 520. That is the number of staff, beachhead staff. The Trump administration says it has hired at the various federal agencies. Beachhead staff are basically spies, or they're guys who kind of like set the stage for populating the agencies.
Are these the ones eliminating all the data from the databases?
Well, so ProPublica, it's the great investigative nonprofit journalism outfit, went and actually found out who these people were. And I just want to read you the description of the man who has been sent to accompany Steve Mnuchin at the Treasury Department.
So he's like, he has to like walk around wherever Steve Mnuchin goes.
It's not clear. I really want to find out more about how this guy is involved in Steve's life. But so this is a man named John Perdue. This is ProPublica's description. John Perdue, a self-described guerrilla warfare expert and fellow at a little-known security think tank, wrote a book called, quote, The War of All the People, The War of Latin American, or The Nexus of Latin American Radicalism and Middle Eastern Terrorism. He is also a one-time contributor to Breitbart. Perdue was featured on CNBC's reality series Make Me a Millionaire Inventor for his invention, the PACBO, which Perdue came up with while studying, quote, collapsed societies and what people who lived in those societies came up with to either defend themselves or to survive. It's a bow and arrow that doubles as a compass, tent pole, walking stick, spear fishing rig, and water purification tablet receptacle. Perdue was hired as a special assistant at the Treasury Department.
I feel like the one thing that Treasury has always lacked has been preppers. Like, we have never had a lot of preppers at Treasury, and it'll be interesting
to
see.
Can you fucking imagine what this guy would have been like in 2008? Just like, shit's going down, man. Get the bow. Get the
stock up
bow.
On canned goods.
I wonder if he's also bought some property in New Zealand, too.
Oh, my God.
I'm sure he's encoded a bunch of Bitcoin into DNA.
On that note.
Okay, I think that's it. I think that's all we have time for this week. Thank you for putting up with us for another week. Many, many thanks to Laurel for turning up and doing her Laurel thing, which was awesome and is awesome. And many thanks as well to Zach Dinerstein, who produced this, or Dinerstein or Dinerstein or something.
Dinerstein is how I call him.
To Zach, winner, winner, chicken dinner. And to Andy Bowers and Steve Ligtai and June Thomas and everyone else who I can't pronounce. Next week, I will have taken my pronunciation lessons and I will be better at pronouncing things. In the meantime, Check out all of the Panoply podcasts at panoply.fm. Leave us a review on the iTunes store. Email us on slatemoney@slate.com. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money. Nothing but a sheet. It ain't nothing but a sheet thing. Real problem.